What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
Darius Dale is the founder and CEO of 42 Macro, the leading macro risk management advisor. In this conversation, we talk about what's going on in the macro economy, what's happening in the financial markets, how Darius is looking at various metrics, and also what you at home should be thinking about as you invest your capital. I really enjoyed this conversation with Darius, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by BCB Group. With a dedicated focus on institutional payment services, BCB Group provides business banking, cryptocurrency, and foreign exchange market liquidity for many of the world's largest crypto-engaged financial institutions. BCB business accounts allow businesses to load fiat currency and cryptocurrencies for payments, operations, and trading purposes. BCB's clients can trade FX and cryptocurrencies quickly and at scale with market-leading value. BCB's Blink Network is the European crypto industry's first instant settlements network and one of the first real-time payment networks of its kind to allow free real-time transactions across fiat and digital currencies. BCB's vision is to empower the global financial revolution through sustainable and innovative banking. You can find out more by visiting bcbgroup.com/pomp today. Again, if you want to learn more, go to bcbgroup.com/pomp today.
Today's episode is brought to you by Exodus, the world's leading desktop, mobile, and hardware crypto wallet. They offer beautiful, user-friendly blockchain products that sync across all of your devices, making it easier to send, receive, and exchange over 150 or more crypto assets in one place. And with world-class customer service available to you 24/7, Exodus always has your back. But the fun doesn't stop with staking and trading. They recently launched a new NFT marketplace where you can buy and sell your favorite NFTs on the Solana network. By partnering with the popular NFT platform Magic Eden, they're offering the full Monty on verified collections, with more added every single day. Ready to check it out for yourself? Run, don't walk, over to exodus.com/pomp for your free download today. Again, if you want the world's leading desktop, mobile, and hardware crypto wallet, go to exodus.com/pomp today. This episode is brought to you by 8Sleep. 8Sleep is the single best product that I have purchased over the last 3 years. It completely changed my life. I'm not joking. Pay attention. The Pod Pro cover, which goes over your mattress by 8Sleep, is the most advanced solution on the market for thermoregulation. It pairs dynamic cooling and heating with biometric tracking. You can go to 8sleep.com/pomp to check out the Pod Pro cover, and you save $150 at checkout. They currently ship within the United States, Canada, and the UK. Now, I told you, it changed my life. It helps me sleep deeper, helps me sleep longer. I feel much more refreshed, and I have better energy. You want to know how I have relentless energy every single day? It's because I sleep on an 8Sleep. Seriously, go check it out, 8sleep.com/pomp today.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Darius Dale, how are you, my friend?
What's up, bud? How you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well, minus the 9.1% inflation that they are dealing with in the United States of America.
Well, it's actually 11% if you look at it on a three-month annualized basis, but who's counting?
Woo! Let's start there. 9.1% is the June 2022 CPI data. You say 11%. Explain the difference.
Yeah, so if you look at it on a year-over-year rate of change basis, so like June of 2022, taking the percentage change from June of 21, you'd wind up at 9.1%. But the more concerning issue is that we continue to accelerate on a trending basis. So looking at it on a three-month annualized percentage change basis, we actually came in at 10.6%. So the time series continues to move away from the Fed's target and pushing us into a direction of more and more tightening. This report was a disaster across the board from the perspective of anybody who is anticipating on inflation, A, returning back towards chin on any reasonable time frame, or B, anticipating a sort of what we've been talking about in the program or Federal Reserve ambulance sirens anytime soon.
So when you see that, why do they use the 9.1%, the 12-month year-over-year versus the three-month annualized? Is it because the 12-month looks better, or is there some other argument?
Well, no. So it's traditionally how you want to calculate in sort of time series for the most part, you know, particularly inflation. You want to look at it on a 12 year-over-year basis, you know, kind of removes all the seasonality that tends to be associated with different cycles in the economy, housing, consumer cycles, et cetera, and so that's the cleanest read on a time series, you know, for something like inflation. The problem is for COVID, we've had so many fits and starts as it relates to the different variants and the proliferation therein that it's been the time series on a year-over-year rate of change basis has been noisy. And to a degree, these inflation statistics are being flattered by some of the sort of advent of Delta that we saw, kind of the beginning of Delta that we saw in the summer of last year. But again, that's not the issue. The issue is that it actually is accelerating sequentially now. If you look at it over the last 3 months and annualize that percentage change, inflation on a headline basis is coming in at 10.6%. That's the fastest number we've seen in a few months. But more importantly, things like core inflation reaccelerating to, you know, where we at 7.7% on a 3 month annualized basis. And my two favorite statistics, something we've been talking about literally all year on the program, are median CPI and sticky CPI. So median CPI, what's the rate of change of all the different different components of the entire CPI basket? There's hundreds of components. That is accelerating to 7.4% on a 3 month annualized basis, which means the median 3 month annualized rate of change of every single thing in the inflation basket is growing at a rate of 7.4%. And then if you look at isolate the variables that are most sticky, that tend to have, that tend to be less responsive to changes in the economy, that tend to have prices move in a much more autocorrelated gradual fashion, that is running at 7.6% on a 3 month annualized basis. That is a 40-year high for that particular time series.
When you start to look at this, we saw the Federal Reserve in November and December talk tough. In 2022, they started to raise interest rates and they've gotten more and more aggressive. They claim that they're going to do quantitative tightening and start selling assets off their balance sheet. While they're doing that, and interest rates are going up, inflation is accelerating as well, both on a year-over-year basis, but also this three-month annualized basis. Why is that happening? And does this mean in July, we're just getting a big fat 1% interest rate hike and they're going to try to bring the big boy weapons to the war now?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one thing that's to answer your question, I think 100 basis points of a rate hike is very much on the table for the Fed's July 27th FOMC meeting. I think the bigger issue is, do they stay at this pace, right? Because right now the Fed is operating currently under a framework that says R star, the neutral rate of the neutral interest rate, the interest rate that, you know, sort of causes the economy to neither accelerate nor decelerate, is somewhere around 2.5%. At least that's what Powell said their estimates were, the committee's estimates were, going back to last FOMC meeting on June 15th. We might start to get to a process whereby the Fed, looking at the data, is sort of saying, hey, look, our policy is being really ineffective in terms of moving the needle on inflation. Maybe we have to revise up our expectations of our star, and then we actually have to start speeding up the pace of tightening. That's something, certainly something that has not happened yet and very much could happen if inflation continues to surprise to the upside in the coming months.
You've got a couple of charts here. The first is U.S. headline CPI, energy and agriculture can't crash fast enough. Explain why you think that.
Yeah, so we've seen, commodity prices, if you look at industrial metals, energy, agricultural prices, energy prices, et cetera, are really starting to decline. I mean, if you look at it on an index basis, you know, industrial metals are off somewhere around 30% off their highs, agricultural and energy around off 20%+ off their highs. But as you can see in the food and energy price inflation, you know, we accelerated to 12.2% on food. We declined to 35% on a 3 month annualized basis for energy, but obviously 35% is not a reasonable number if you're trying to get inflation under control. And that's my point, is that it's going to take time for the moves in commodity markets to be reflected in inflation statistics. It could take several months before those kinds of moves are actually, you know, adequately pushing inflation statistics down. So that's the first chart. That's kind of the first key takeaway there. It's that we might have to go through some more pain over a number of months before we actually see those declines reflected in the statistics.
When you look at this next chart that we have here, you've got that both goods and service prices are melting up. Explain this.
Yeah, so this is goes back to something we talked about this winter. We were like, hey, look, there's the goods disinflation is likely to become the driver of core CPI. And for a moment there, it was causing core CPI to slow because we saw sort of the unwind of supply chain disruptions. We saw sort of consumers shift their purchasing, the dominance of their purchasing from goods to services. That's something that's happened in the first half of this year as well. If you look at the sort of the rate of change between goods and services, about a 9 to 10, about 1,000 basis points of a difference between the growth rate of services consumption and the growth rate of goods consumption. So that caused for a brief moment in time, core inflationary pressures to back off because goods was moving down faster than services was going up. Well, now you got both of them going up simultaneously. If you look at, again, I mentioned goods, core goods inflation was at 6.6%, core services inflation at 8.2%. You know, those two numbers are moving away from the actual year-over-year time series, which tells you that we're still building momentum to the upside in core inflationary pressures. And this is exactly what you would expect. Inflation is a lagging indicator to the broader economic cycle, and you typically see core inflationary pressures peter out last as you head into start and sort of middle parts of a recession.
You've got leading indicators are rocketing past the moon, which is just an all-time title for a slide. What does this say? Yeah.
Thank you. Just to borrow some crypto lingos, let the kids know that I'm still hip. So what we're showing here in this chart, as I mentioned, the first set of bars, the gray, by the way, to explain these bars, the gray bar just shows the prior month's 3-month annualized rate of change. And the blue bar is the most recent month, so June. As you can see, we're moving in the wrong direction if we're trying to get core PCE down, right? Median CPI, again, the median of everything in the inflation basket, is now accelerating at a 7.4% annualized rate of change. It's the highest 3-month rate of change, annualized rate of change we've ever seen in median CPI as time series goes back to the early 80s. If you look at it, the Atlanta Fed's got a sticky CPI, as I mentioned earlier. That basket is accelerating at 7.6% on a 3-month annualized basis, the fastest print we've seen since August of 1982. Neither you nor I nor John were born in August of 1982. So the Fed's got a real serious inflation problem on their hands. And what I mean by that is that those two time series are very highly correlated to the third set of bars, which is core PCE, which is the Fed's preferred inflation metric. So that's obviously an issue.
When you look at this last one, overheating by double, what is this showing us?
Yeah, so this goes back to why I believe the Fed is very likely to remain very aggressive. There's a distribution of policy outcomes, right? The market is always pricing in some probability of XYZ happening across the curve, you know, 25 basis point hike, 50 basis point hike, 75 basis point hike. Now we're having a legitimate discussion about 100 basis point hike, which I'm not sure has ever happened in the U.S. Maybe it has, but certainly not in recent years. Probably Paul Volcker, I would imagine, gave us quite a few of those. But anyway, so when the Fed looks at the economy, it looks at the economy through two lenses. It looks at everything through three lenses. One, financial stability. That's kind of taking a backseat for now. Number two, the inflation. That's obviously the dominant driver of policy and has been and will likely continue to be the dominant driver of Fed policy for the medium term. But then there's also the labor market. And so when the Fed looks at the labor market, they see a labor market that is truly and realistically overheating by a double. And what I mean by that, if unpacking this chart, the light blue bar show the sort of the trend annual 3-month annualized rate of change in the 2015, in the 5 years that ended 2019. So it's sort of like, hey, how do we trend it just, you know, across, you know, multiple years and cycles and swings in the economy? What's sort of the baseline rate of change? That's the blue bars. And this, the gray bars just show the previous month, and then the dark blue bars show the most recent month. And as you can see from a private payrolls perspective, that's private employment, total non-farm payrolls in the private sector. You know, we're growing at basically double the rate that we've grew at in the pre-crisis in the pre-pandemic trend. If you look at the second clustering of bars, which is average hourly earnings, you know that 3-month annualized rate of change, the dark blue bars, double what we're seeing relative to the light blue bar, which again was our baseline prior to the pandemic. And then you take your eyes over to the far set of bars, which is kind of the real kind of key takeaway that tells the Fed they need to keep their foot very much firmly pressed on the brake here. If you look at private sort of aggregate income growth for the private sector, when you productize all those three different variables between total payroll, employment, average hourly earnings, and average hours worked, you know, we're running at 8% through the June jobs report. That's basically a double relative to where our trend rate of aggregate private sector income grew at in the 2015 and 2019 timeframe. So in our estimation, the Federal Reserve, the thousands of wonky PhD economists who are doing research just like we are doing, are looking at the labor market and saying it's giving them like four thumbs up. You know, it's the Rick James, like, I wish I had more hands. They're getting four thumbs up to keep hiking rates, to keep doing very aggressive quantitative tightening until they are confirmed that they have broken something. and they have not confirmed they've broken anything yet.
We've seen people like Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan. They continue to say, hey, there's a very complex situation at play, very unprecedented. We don't know what's going to happen. They pause share buybacks. They are also kind of strengthening their balance sheet in preparation for potentially more issues in their loan book. But at the same time, we see the Morgan Stanley CEO saying that a deep and severe recession is unlikely in the United States. What do you think most of the major players, these people have so much information at their fingertips. They have these massive, you know, teams of analysts. Why are they so confident or seem to be so sure that we aren't going to head to very, very bad economic times, given the aggressiveness that it appears the Fed is going to have to pursue in interest rate hikes to get this inflation down?
Well, let's be honest here, right? Like, Jamie Dimon is the head of a major, major U.S. bank, major multinational corporation. You know, he's not going to go out and spook all of his clients and tell them to do very, you know, aggressive things like withdraw capital, et cetera, and basically shut down the financial sector. So he's not incentivized to tell people how bad it's likely to be. And quite frankly, I'm not sure he knows, right? At the end of the day, I don't think anyone knows the real depth and magnitude of the recession we're likely to enter at some point over the medium term, because the reality is, you know, a lot of nonlinear things tend to happen in recession that either make it better or worse. Right? Like, what if we're in recession in Q4 and then Russia decides to cut off all the gas to Europe? Europe goes into a Great Depression and makes our terms of trade significantly worse. And obviously corporate earnings, et cetera, get significantly worse. Or, you know, what if China has a banking crisis, which is something that's making the rumors and rounds in recent days? You know, there's a lot of things that happen when growth is slowing and liquidity is tightening. And so the reality is, I don't think anyone truly knows. But going back to the Fed wants a mild recession. They won't tell you that. But we've done a tremendous amount of work, I think as much work as anybody I've seen, in terms of quantifying the impact of recessions on things like labor, corporate profits, the market itself, and more importantly, inflation. And when you look at it from an inflation perspective, it's not really clear that there is a, you know, statistically significant relationship between the size of recessions and the drawdown we typically see in the Fed's preferred inflation metric, which is core PCE inflation. And so the Fed, but the one thing we do know is that you do need to get a recession to experience a drawdown of some sort. And the reality is, I think the Fed is well aware of that. Again, if I can sit in here, just a guy in a room and figure that out, certainly the thousands of PhD economists at the Federal Reserve can figure that out as well. And so ultimately, again, they're not going to tell you they'd like a mild recession, but the reality is they're not going to get inflation down without it.
We recently saw Vladimir Putin, he was in like a meeting, and he was talking about essentially claiming checkmate on the global economy. And he was saying that when Russia invaded Ukraine, that was the end of the U.S. dollar dominance on a global basis. And we now are headed towards a multipolar world. And I'm always careful to point out, I don't agree with most of what he's probably done. And in no way do I want to seem supportive of that specific individual or his actions. But I do think that time and again, he has continued to talk about the macro economy in a way that appears to be more honest or a different viewpoint than what we hear in the mainstream media in the United States of America. And so his argument was the financial sanctions proved to the world that you have to be friends with the U.S. in order to continue to be using the U.S. dollar system, right? Or they could kick you out, freeze you, take your foreign reserves, all this stuff. How much do the sanctions specifically play into the inflation that we're seeing? Because we're now a couple of months after, right? There was this talk maybe back in like March, I think, is when we first heard the Biden administration say, you know, Putin gas hike and the sanctions and kind of the actions. But they had only invaded in like the end of February. So it was unlikely that you were really going to get kind of price impact for something that had only existed for 2 weeks. Now we're 3, 4, 5 months later. It feels like now actually there could be price impact, but I don't know how to think about that. Like, how do you think through sanctions, geopolitical conflict, and then like we have this super high inflation? How do you unpack how much of it is contributing to the inflation?
Ooh, that's a loaded question, my friend. So I'll try to address the various components. So, you know, you talked about sanctions. Like, one, I think you and I spoke about this in recent episodes, which is, you know, when you go back and look at where inflation was in January of 22, you know, prior to Russia crossing one border in Ukraine, you know, we were at 7.5%, and now we're at 9.1% again year over year for the month of June. So if you assume Russia added all that inflation, you know, maybe they've added, you know, let's call it 260 basis points of inflation. That's 160 basis points of inflation. That's obviously Russia has not caused all that inflation. So there very clearly is a legitimate inflation problem in the U.S. economy. Again, we just spent 5 minutes talking about how the labor market is overheating by a double that is generating a for lack of a better word, a crap ton of inflation domestically. And that's further supported by core services inflation being at 8%. Russia has very little to do with our services inflation, our housing bubble that the Fed and the fiscal government created in the pandemic era. But going back to the sort of, the specific impact of inflations, I think it's really difficult to sort of draw a one-to-one, these are very dynamic, impossible to model ecosystems, right? It's almost like the butterfly effect to some degree, but one thing we can sort of do is sort of a cross-sectional analysis to sort of understand kind of the relative impact of something like sanctions, right? We'll never be able to know what the actual true basis point amount of sanctions are, but we can look at something like the spread between U.S. inflation relative to the rest of the developed world's inflation. And right now, if you factor in the most recent print, we're somewhere around 160, 170 basis points higher than the rest of the world's developed world, the Western world's inflation rates. That's in the 95th percentile of all readings going back as far back as we can get the data, 50, 60, 70 years. And so it's telling you that there are inflationary pressures in the U.S. economy that are very much separate and apart from things like sanctions, et cetera, which are obviously impacting everyone at the same time.
John, what questions do you have?
Darius, I'm curious about we are obviously heading into unprecedented times. No one really knows what's going on. What are people doing with liquidity? Are people storing dry powder? And then how do you measure how much liquidity is being dried up or in the market currently?
Yeah, great question, John. It's good to see you, man. To answer your question, yes, we are seeing some storing of dry powder, but it's not necessarily as a function of investment decision-making, right? The federal government through $6.5 trillion into the economy through stimulus checks, PPP, et cetera, et cetera. And so we saw a dramatic uptick in the share, in the ratio of sort of a household cash and checkable deposits. So basically cash as a percent of overall net worth that went from basically 1% to 3%. So households are much more capitalized from a cash perspective, liquidity perspective, than they have been in recent cycles. But the reality is, if you look at, still where the share of ownership for things stocks, et cetera, more risky assets, those are coming off all-time highs. What suffered in that relationship in that basket has obviously been the household's allocation of fixed income, which has been and continues to track at an all-time low. So, but that's just only one factor, one side of the liquidity. I mean, that's sort of the liquidity that will be used in the real economy and in the real economy. The liquidity from the perspective of the financial markets, the one that we care about the most as investors, if you look at sort of Federal Reserve supply liquidity or net liquidity from that channel, and then there's also the net liquidity it's provided from the fiscal channel through the lens of the Treasury General Account. And when we do the math on this, and I'll slow down when I say this, our math suggests we could see over $900 billion of net liquidity drained from now through year end. That's bigger than the entire drainage of net liquidity we saw in the sort of 21 months between, kind of mid 17 and mid 2019 as a function of the previous quantitative tightening program. So we're trying to squeeze more than 21 months of QT in through the pipe in 6 months. The Fed will break something. I'm convinced about that. I think it's pretty clear at this point they're going to break something if they try to do that. Because again, the markets don't know how to digest that removal, the size of that removal of liquidity. It's such a truncated period of time, and it's our expectation that that's going to cause some problems this fall.
What are the biggest losers when that happens?
Go to the riskiest part of the spectrum. If you look at the spectrum of risks, and those are the things that get destroyed. When liquidity dries up, it dries up in the fringes first, and it just keeps drying up and takes one asset class after another until eventually it's getting close to your beloved S&P 500. So obviously we saw our friend Kathy Wood and her narratives basically got punted starting in Q1 of last year. And we've since seen various sectors, style factors, small caps, cyclical, high beta cyclicals, et cetera, within the equity market. All that stuff has taken turns in terms of peaking. I mean, you go back and look, the NASDAQ peaked in November, and then finally the S&P 500 peaked in January. And so, when you talk about a reduction in liquidity, what's really happening just from a technical standpoint, and I think this is important to explain as well, what the Fed is doing, the Fed is not selling bonds into the market. The Fed is not dumb enough to do that, at least not yet. Maybe they will. But what they're really doing is saying, hey, we've been this gigantic buyer, at least on the secondary market, but we all can assume that it's basically the primary market because the Fed is controlling the primary dealers. They've been this entire gigantic buyer of U.S. treasuries throughout the, let's call it, the last few years. What they're doing is they're stepping away and forcing us as investors, as the private sector, to capitalize the U.S. government. And the issue with that process is we generally run max invested as the private sector. You know, maybe you might not be fully invested, but your cash is someone else's, your asset is someone else's liability. And so the reality is that as the Federal Reserve steps away to the tune of, let's call it, $900 billion over the next 6 months, we're going to have to capitalize that. We're going to have to roll over U.S. debt. We're going to have to capitalize the incremental debt issuance that they're doing to the tune of $900+ billion. That money's got to come from somewhere. It's going to come from, you're not going to sell Bitcoin to buy a U.S. Treasury bond. But you think about this as the cascading process. Price of Bitcoin goes down and the price of small caps go down. The price of S&P goes down. The price of Apple credit goes down. And eventually people have enough liquidity that they need to capitalize the government. Because, again, it's at the top of the global capital structure. If it needs money, it's going to get money.
Gotcha. So while we are recording this, we've got Wehler from the Fed is spouting off. And I'm just going to read you a couple of the quotes that are pretty incredible. First, yesterday's inflation number was not a big surprise. What is your reaction to the Fed members now? I mean, what?
Wait, what? We went from transitory last year to we're expecting 9-10% inflation? That was quick. I mean, look, Chris Waller and Jim Bullard, Chris Waller and Jim Bullard, both formerly of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, they probably do as much data collection and analysis as anybody out there. You know, they've been well out front in expecting higher inflation, mm-hmm. above target inflation surprises, and thus have been well out front in leading their colleagues on the FOMC to getting to, you know, leading them to the water that is higher interest rates and more quantitative tightening. So perhaps it wasn't a surprise to him because he's been sounding the alarm bell all along. Like, look, you guys need to hurry up. This is getting worse and worse and worse. The issue with it as it relates to the broader markets is that, you know, that consensus is now starting to become the modal outcome. Or sorry, that view is now becoming the consensus modal outcome amongst FOMC participants. We saw Cleveland Fed's Loretta Mester talk about the specter of 100 basis point rate hike, said she wouldn't rule it out. Mary Daly, who inherited, you know, Janet Yellen's seat at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, which is traditionally a very dovish leaning branch, is also signing off. She said she's comfortable with 100 basis point rate hike. So I think Chris Waller is effectively taking somewhat of a career victory lap, saying, hey, look, I told you so. Let's get going.
A second quote is that the market pricing for 100 basis points is getting ahead of themselves.
Ooh.
For July.
Pushing back on that. Pushing back. Okay, that is an incrementally dovish commentary relative to where we closed yesterday. And so if he's saying the market's getting ahead of itself, what he's effectively saying is that, hey, look, we haven't gotten the boss to sign off on this yet. What typically happens, and this is my own interpretation of how the process works, is whenever they need to change their messaging, the FOMC, they push whoever's the most hawkish or the most dovish out of the door and just have them, you know, kind of set off a cascading series of commentary. And so perhaps Jerome Powell is pushing Mr. Wall out of the door and say, hey, just tone it down, try to get the market to tone down this pricing of 100 basis point rate hike. Perhaps the Fed is not comfortable with that. But ultimately, whether or not we get 100 basis points or not, is there really any functional difference between 100 basis point rate hike and a 75 basis point rate hike heading into recession? Are you going to go from selling risk assets to buying risk assets if they only do 75 basis points? No, obviously the answer is no. We don't really truly understand the real, there's no real linear impact of financial tightening on the economy. We just know when you tighten, things get worse, and when you ease, things get better. That's about as good as we can do as economists. So I'm not particularly fazed by that, but I do think it's interesting relative to a Fed that seemed to be very sort of acquiescent to allowing the market to move them towards incrementally hawkish policy. But I guess it looks like they're putting the line in the sand, perhaps on 75 basis points.
Trying. Last thing is he says that he doesn't necessarily see that the United States has to suffer a recession. And he believes that unemployment essentially have to explode higher in order for that to occur. Do you think that is the only metric that would have to move for the recession to happen? And do you think that he is correct in saying that we don't have to suffer a recession if they keep doing what they're doing?
No, so he's dead wrong on that. Again, that's slide 73 through 80 in our July macro scouting report. We published that last Friday. I think we've done a lot more work than he has on the impact of recessions on inflation. And to answer his question, you have to have a recession to get inflation where they are projecting it to be by the end of next year. You know, the Fed has a 2.7% core PCE forecast Q4 for 2023. To get from where we are at 4.7% in the most recent month, which might be going up actually just based on this move we've seen in core inflation measures, particularly median and sticky CPI, we got to do a hell of a lot of damage to the economy, particularly the labor economy, in order for that to occur, in order to get core PCE down at 2.7%. So he's dead wrong on that view. And ultimately, you know, we think the markets are going to have to be surprised by the reality that, hey, look, we need a recession in order to get inflation down. And once you get into recessionary conditions, you know, it becomes very nonlinear. As I mentioned, all sorts of things could happen that can make it either better or worse. And the reality is we just have to be there and be humble Bayesians when that's occurring as investors.
Where can we send people to find you on the internet or learn more about 42 Macro? At this point, if people aren't subscribed to 42 Macro, after you hear this just absolute incredible articulation of what's going on in the world, I don't know what you guys are doing, but where can we send people to check out more?
I appreciate that kind endorsement, my friend. So 42macro.com is our website. Come check it out. We got a bunch of sample research out there for you. Kind of check out what you might like, what you don't like, what might be helpful for you. And then if you can't afford it, that's all good. We do our macro minute every day for those who have smaller budgets, smaller trading, smaller size. And then definitely follow me on Twitter at 42MacroDDale. Appreciate y'all.
You're killing it, man. All right. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Later. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed this one. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. And if you're looking to try to transition to get a new job in the Bitcoin or crypto industry, we've got you covered. Head over to pompscryptocourse.com. We've developed a curriculum with the top teams across the industry. It's a 3-week intensive training program with over 50 events packed into that 3-week time period. Go to pompscryptocourse.com to learn more, and I'll meet you guys for the next episode.